Good morning. My name is Bruce Berner, and I teach in the Law School at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And today's session deals with a set of legal issues that travel under a variety of names, duress, coercion, necessity, choice of evils. And I want to begin today, before we look at anything on the blue sheet, we'll deal with those problems later. I want to begin by putting all of you, metaphysically only, of course, into a situation, and then describe some of the choices you have and some of the problems that confront you. And then I'll be a resource person to help you perhaps sort out some of the difficulties you're having. And then we'll have you make some decisions as to what will happen. There's certain things you can't decide will happen, but certain things you can. Then we'll discuss your actions after we're done. There are five people involved in the problem, and as I talk about them, you may wish to identify yourself with any one of them. You don't have to, and I'm going to leave their descriptions open enough that I think you can find one of them to kind of associate with. These are five people who are going to end up going together to explore caves. This particular problem is usually covered in law schools under the title of the Case of the Spelunkian Explorers, and it has a variety of different kind of setups, but I'll give you one of the more typical ones. We start with Alan and Betty. Alan and Betty, as the H and W and the arrow indicate, are married to each other. We don't know their ages exactly. You can kind of fit those ages to you if you like. At any rate, they still enjoy the outdoor life. They still enjoy exploring caves. It's one of the few things they like to do together. Right. So Alan and Betty are cave explorers. At church one day, they find a young woman who they have never met before, and they get to talking, and it turns out that she is a Spelunkian explorer herself, just moved to that part of the country, enjoyed exploring caves where she lived before, is delighted to find that there are caves here, and would love to join them sometime, and by the way, so would her brother, Charlie, who's also an experienced Spelunkian explorer, and who also lives in the area. Both Charlie and Darlene are unmarried at this point. But unlike some brothers and sisters, they like each other, and they get along, and they like to do things together. The particular weekend that they choose to go, which is a Memorial Day weekend, so that they will have 3 days, because it's a fairly long hike they're going to take, and a long and complicated series of caves that they're going to explore. On that particular weekend, one of Charlie's old college buddies, Eddie, is in town. He hasn't done a lot of cave exploration in the past. He's not real sure of all of this, but he does want to spend some time with his friend Charlie, and so he agrees that he will go along. And so the five of them set off. With quite a bit of gear, as spelunkers are wont to take, and probably about 3 or 4 days worth of food. They leave on a Friday. They expect to come back on a Monday. Since they know that this activity is somewhat dangerous and they can get cut off under certain circumstances, they do manage to take with them a shortwave radio. It would have been better if they had checked to make sure the battery was totally fresh. It wasn't totally fresh, but it had some life left in it. The first morning that they are out, they are deep within one of the caves when there is a horrible cave. They find themselves trapped in a chamber roughly the size of this room, just the five of them. They have lanterns, and so they are able to see. But after several hours of trying, it's very clear to them that they cannot budge anything. They make the best of it for a while. They talk. They assume maybe something will break rather quickly, and it doesn't. They eat a little bit of the store of rations that they've brought along. They have plenty of water. That's not going to be a problem. And provided they don't have to stay there more than 3 days, food won't be a problem either. The problem, of course, is they have no idea if anyone even knows where they are. They fire up the shortwave radio, and fortunately, they are able to make contact with a ranger who works in the area. And they can identify roughly where they are. Alan and Betty know the area well enough that they can describe to the ranger where they are. The ranger is very concerned, of course, had been aware of the cave-in. And once he finds out where exactly they are, he knows that they're in deep trouble because they are well, well inside the mountain. He agrees to try to help them. He organizes a rescue party. So trucks are brought to the site. There's a picture of kind of a buzzing of activity. And they promise they'll get right on. He also makes available to them to talk over their shortwave radio to a variety of people that he brings to the site. A doctor, a lawyer, a pastor who specializes in popular theology, what I will just call popular theology. He went to the seminary for popular theology, and maybe he will be of some help to them as well. And the captain of the rescue team, who can tell them a little bit about the rescue efforts. Now, you are the folks in the cave at this point, and I will be any of those people that I mentioned were topside, and I'm happy in their stead to answer any questions that you might have about the predicament in which you find yourself. And if there are other people that you can think of that you would like to talk to, I can probably produce them on a moment's notice. So there's your situation. So I'm on this end of the radio, and you're all on that end of the radio.
I want to talk to the captain of the rescue squad, find out how long I'm going to be here.
He's right here. Let me put him on. Yes, who am I talking to?
Alan.
Hi, Alan. How are you? I understand you're down just east of Ghost Bend inside the cave, correct?
I assume that's where we're at, yes.
We're assessing the situation out here. I'm sorry to tell you this, but it's a pretty bad cave-in. Some of the rocks are pretty big. We're not exactly certain yet, but it looks to us like it's going to be between 20 and 30 days before we can get to you. Unless we might catch a break. These cave-ins are tricky. We've had cases where one this bad, we've actually been able to get to the people in 10 days. Others where, I'm sorry to tell you, it was 6 months before we could get there. But my best guess at this point is 25 days.
Ask if we have enough oxygen.
Yeah, me too.
we're pretty certain you do. The way these things work, we're pretty certain. There's five of you? Well, there are five.
Too many.
Well, certainly the fewer people you have, the more oxygen there will be to go around. Hard to argue with that, but I don't think that's going to be a problem. I think you'll have the oxygen. I could be wrong. I would suggest that you not use the lanterns unless you really have to. That would certainly help the oxygen situation. If you're not getting ventilation, that could be a problem.
Someone has claustrophobia.
You're in trouble if you have claustrophobia. I can do a lot right now. I can tell you a lot of things. I cannot move the rocks at this point. Yes?
I'd like to talk to the doctor.
Okay, he's right here. Yes, hello.
Okay, I'd like to know how should we most effectively use our water supply?
You have the water you brought in the canteens, mm-hmm. And from what I've heard, I don't think water is going to be a problem. You people have brought a tremendous amount of water. In that, you are very fortunate. So I don't think that will be a problem. You certainly don't want to use it for any purpose other than to drink it. And then only when you are very, very thirsty and feel you need it. So I would be prudent with it, but I don't think you need to be concerned about the water. I believe you have enough from what I've been told.
Could you be more specific than that? Like, are we talking a few ounces a day or what?
I would say, from what I've been told you have, that you could drink as many as 10 ounces a day.
Okay, thanks. I would like to speak to the pastor.
He's right here.
Well, I would like for him to have a lot of people pray for us that we can get out of here.
I'm happy to make sure that they are. We've got a rally going at my church tonight. A cookout, by the way. We're having a rally for your safety and your recovery. And so we will certainly, and we'll put it in the newsletter as well, so it'll reach the future.
How about the ranger? Let's see. I assume the slide fell blocking our entrance that we came in. Is there another way out?
No, that's blocked as well.
Oh, that's blocked.
Where you are, there's basically the one way in. You're kind of at the end of kind of a cul-de-sac. There is a very small way out, very difficult way out the back. But I've heard from the ranger on the south side of the mountain that's even worse than up here. So the way we're going to come after you is the same way that you went in. And that's going to be 5 or 10 times faster than coming in the other way. So no, you've got the one way. And that's the way we're coming. We've got people here. We've called people in from other areas. Understand, we can only get so many people to work at one time anyway, owing to space. So we've got as many people working on it as we can put on the job.
I'd like to talk to the nutritionist. What's the best way we can use our available food to stretch it out? That won't be a risk for us for starvation over a 30-day time frame.
That's kind of the really bad news. You know, the water part was the pretty good news. You have enough of that, but from our information, what you have, you brought enough for 3 days eating ordinarily, but eating at the levels of just to sustain your life, we figure 12 days is all. After that, you're going to begin to see symptoms of starvation. Again, as with the water, eat as little as possible. I'd give a little more to the weaker people, but that's not really a question for a nutritionist. You might want the pastor back on that one, but I'm just thinking prudentially, the weaker people may need a little bit more.
Is there anything else that we might be able to digest in here to help us with our...
Well,
as far as minerals or rocks or bats or...
No, there's nothing so far, and I've talked to the ranger, there's nothing inside the cave where you are which would be even potentially edible.
If worst comes to worst, I don't want to kill anybody, but what body parts could we cut off to eat?
We never covered that in nutrition school.
Not organ meat.
That was an elective course, and I didn't take it. It's certainly. Do you have knives?
There are survival kits.
Yeah. It's at least conceivable that you could eat portions of bodies. Yes, that's conceivable. Nutrition-wise, that can sustain life.
But I don't want to kill anyone, so I want to do all the non-bite work.
Well, I guess I'd start by calling for volunteers. If you don't get any volunteers, then I think the next step is violence of one kind or another. But you've hit upon what's obviously looming.
I'm Eddie, and it looks pretty dismal down here, I tell you.
Yeah.
And I just came here to visit my friend Charlie, and I thought these people knew what they were doing. I want to talk to a lawyer. I don't have any insurance, and I'm never going to be the same. And these people let me down here. I really thought they knew what they were doing.
Okay, this is the lawyer speaking now, I'd be happy to talk to you. About the case you have against these people when you get out. Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, now, I may not make it, but I want my wife and children to have something. They're going to be left on their own.
First consultation is usually free, isn't it?
The first consultation is free, and I'll tell you what, in a little bit, I'll send my secretary to get your name and phone number and that information, and I'll have a witness here to attest to your hiring me. So then, in the event you die, I will take that case on your behalf, so that your family will be
taken care of.
You see how terribly helpful lawyers are in this particular situation. They are the most vital person to talk to, because they will handle the case later. Yes, sir.
Will you write my will as well?
Yes.
Thank you.
Easily done, this is kind of an interesting situation for will making, because usually wills have to be written and signed and two witnesses, but the law has a provision for this kind of emergency situation where you can make what's called a nuncupative will. Fancy term for one that you make without writing it or signing it. So yeah, we can take care of that.
How about getting a lawyer out of there and getting somebody that can dig?
The lawyer's not in the way. The diggers are digging. They are going as fast as they can, and they have as many of them as they need.
Can we dig from this side?
Huh?
Can we dig from this side?
I would not suggest that you do any digging at all. The energy that it takes you.
Great. Is sit around?
And stay as quiet as possible, turn the lanterns off, eat and drink as little as possible. The theologian just whispered to me that praying would be a very fine option for all of you. Now, I want to move us a little bit down the way here. We are now at day 20. You've been in contact each day via shortwave radio to the people at the site. You need to conserve that battery so you don't stay on the radio too long with them. But it's now day 20. Alan and Darlene are getting extremely weak. Extremely weak. And the others are despairing a bit of their ability to make it. Betty and Charlie are okay, not great obviously, but they're not at the same stage of exhaustion and weaknesses as, did I say Alan and Darlene? Yeah. Eddie is kind of in between. Okay. So he's not real good. He's not feeling real good. Nobody's spirits are very good at this point. But in terms of physical weakness, we're getting tremendous weakness at this point from Alan and Darlene. So I'll put you back in charge. It doesn't appear to most of you that Darlene is going to make it even another day. Al's not quite that bad, but he's not good. So we're back on the radio.
How close are we? How close are we to rescue?
I would say about 10 days, maybe sooner. We thought, as of last night, we thought we were really making progress, and then we had a secondary cave. Fortunately, none of our team was killed, although two of them are hurt pretty severely and trapped themselves. So we have that problem. But even with all that, 10 days is our best guess. Again, this is very unscientific with this kind of cave-in. We just don't know what's in front of us there. We're about 150 feet from you. That helps. But we're not usually making more than 12 or 15 feet progress a day the way it lines up there. You want the nutritionist there?
I have no more questions. No. Right.
You have any more questions for anybody?
I want the doctor.
Hmm?
I want the doctor.
Okay, he's on. You want him on the radio? Oh, you want him there? We can't get him there.
Anything that can be done for Darlene at this point?
Her respirations are shallow. Do
you have any food left? The answer is no, yeah. Who are you asking?
For Darlene.
Yeah, but who are you talking to? I know, who am I?
Well, I'm talking to the doctor.
Medically, at this point, the doctor would probably talk through a lot of very specific symptoms with you and find out. And let's say that at the result of that, he'd be talking about pulse rates and a lot of other things. At that rate, the doctor would conclude that Darlene has about a day and maybe two. And there's nothing you can do for Darlene short of getting food to her.
She wants to talk to the pastor.
Pardon me?
She wants to talk to the pastor
for last
rites.
Okay. We can arrange for that. So we can take care of the pastoral duties. We can get a priest I'm not a Catholic myself, so I don't know if last rites can be performed in that kind of distance situation. Is that possible? Okay.
I'm sure the Catholic priest, regardless.
Right. Yeah. So he will do that. So we can take care of that for Darlene. You could. The doctor now remembers. It is possible. Come back to what you said before that human flesh is consumable. And that would have the capacity for lengthening her life a bit. Whether it's long enough depends on when we can get there, and we're not certain. Let's shift to day 25. That was day 20. We'll shift to day 25, and certain things have happened. Darlene is still with us, as is Alan. But Darlene's situation is worse. Alan's situation is worse. And the people in the cave have begun to talk about the fact that if they don't do something fast, it looks like they all might simply die. And so they've begun to discuss amongst themselves the possibility of eating one of them. One is enough, by the way. Everyone but Eddie appears to be in agreement with this plan. Eddie wants no part of this plan because the plan, well, let's ask, how would you go about the plan, even if you made the jump, the decision to eat the flesh, how would you select?
Eddie?
Yeah, why? Why is Eddie the best candidate?
Because he won't have to really have a direct role in this plan.
Well, Eddie's the only one who's retained a lawyer at this point, so you know, I don't know. Eddie's the only one down there, of course, who does not have a relative in the cave with him. He and Charlie were college friends, but they're reassessing how good that friendship ever was. Yes?
Well, I'm Charlie, and I just want to talk to a pastor. We've been discussing this amongst ourselves, and we've kind of concluded that if we don't do something, we're all going to die. One thought we had was the first one that dies would like to be a donor rep, you know, much like you donate eyes or organs. We're wrestling with the moral dilemma of cannibalism, and it's revulsive to us, but on the other hand, we want others to live. Is there any theological background or support you can give us for voluntary donation of organs and body parts for the purpose of feeding survivors?
Yeah, so you're talking about simply waiting for a person to die, and then after they die, would this be with their prior agreement?
That's correct, yeah. We're all willing to sign the donor agreement except for Eddie.
Okay. Okay.
And we have hands here, so we can...
So you're not talking about killing anyone. You're talking about waiting until the first person dies. And then if that person was in agreement...
That's correct, yeah.
We're
willing to donate our body, and at the same time we'll donate our eyes and so forth for others.
Okay.
If you can reach us in time.
I don't think, and certainly in my training, there's no theological difficulties with that, certainly if those persons have agreed ahead of time. Now, you say Eddie hasn't?
No, Eddie hasn't.
So if he dies first, you have a different kind of moral problem than if he hasn't.
That's true.
My friend, the lawyer here, would suggest that after Eddie dies, you might ask him again, and then remember... Remember that in the law, silence is consent. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, and that's certainly one level that the problem can work out. Once we're dealing with waiting for someone to die, then we're not going to generate any particular kind of legal problems, at least no homicide-related sort of legal issues. One of the problems factually with this is it's not at all clear that waiting for the first person to die may not advance you to the point where the people left have the strength to do any more. And of course, I'm going to string you out. I'm not going to let anybody die prior to the point where you have to come to grips with the other, the more difficult theological question, which is killing someone. And then, of course, the problem is Eddie's not willing to be part of that system either, that lottery either. So we get two questions. What about the four who are willing to be in a sort of lottery? And then what about Eddie? Would you like to talk to anybody about that? I want you to assume you've reached the point where you know that any further delay of eating a body is going to result in the death of everyone. Yes,
can ma'am? We just, instead of killing somebody, just cut off their leg and just eat the leg?
Yes, you can, but I think that the doctor will tell you that that will almost assuredly result in their death anyway.
Yeah.
So that would just become the way of killing. Yes.
I'm Alan, and there's really no chance for me to survive, so I would volunteer to have someone end my life because I don't think I can make it back.
And
save the others here.
Exactly. That's wonderful. That's a marvelously Christian thing to do. Who's in a position? How will they do this? Will you manage this yourself, or will you assign someone this task?
Got a rope, and we'll hang it over a rock or something.
No, I would suggest that you get a pan and cut one of the arteries, and that's a very, real peaceful way, and then you could have the blood for the other people to drink. One of my concerns about these, at this point, I've been, but this point in time, that they wouldn't be able to digest flesh. They're utterly sick. That's just a logistical thing.
Utterly sick is a pretty good option at this point.
Your stomach would not, anybody that's been starving cannot hack raw meat. Now, the blood, that might be something to sustain.
You've really thrown kind of a monkey wrench into this, because when the actual case is played out, one of the things that is prohibited from the beginning as part of the exercise is to prohibit a volunteer. A volunteer, especially a volunteer who is willing to do the act himself or herself, which produces his or her death, really solves the legal problem. So I want to assume that we don't have a volunteer. One person is going to have to undertake to kill another person. Four of them would be willing to enter into some agreement, some kind of lottery system. Eddie apparently is not willing to enter the lottery. And just as this is being discussed with the people upside, and the lawyer will tell you, the lawyer will be very helpful. The lawyer will be happy to read to you the murder statute, which says any person who intentionally kills another person without justification commits murder. You would immediately ask whether this is legal justification. The lawyer would tell you that he does not know. There is no case of this type in not only in this state, but in American jurisprudence. There is an early case from Great Britain, a lifeboat case, in which this issue was raised and talked about, but the case was decided on other grounds because it turned out there were three people on that boat, and one was a cabin boy, and the two adults just decided to kill him. There was no lottery or anything else, so and they killed him way before they needed to. It's a very famous case called Dudley and Stevens case. So the lawyer will tell you he can't help you. The pastor, and remember, this is a pastor of popular theology, so he doesn't come from any denomination that you or I belong to, is willing to give you two pieces of guidance. One is that God sees everyone suffering, and not even a sparrow could be harmed without God taking severe notice. He also tells you that God helps those that help himself. And with those two pieces of popular theology, he leaves you alone. At that point, where were we? Day 25. That situation lingered. It didn't resolve itself until on day 28, radio contact is finally lost. The five people are reached on day 35. Eddie is dead. The other four are alive, though barely. The pathology indicates that Eddie was killed with a blow to the head with a blunt instrument. Mm-hmm. Tests indicate that the blunt instrument was a small rock found inside the cave. The large portions of Eddie's upper left and right leg have been eaten. Charlie admits that he did the actual killing. He claims that on day 30, all five agreed to a lottery. Eddie lost the lottery. Charlie lost the lottery, which designated the person to do the act. There is some evidence of a struggle. There's skin under Eddie's fingernails and scratches on Charlie's face. And Charlie and the others are now prosecuted for murder. And the question is, how ought that case come out? Anyone know what that sound is?
Water.
It's not a cave, is it?
Yeah.
What do you think? What are some of the legal issues there? Yeah.
Maybe when you read enough food, you can probably become delirious and quit pleading insanity or something.
Yeah, you complete something like insanity. It's not mental disease or defect, but it would be some kind of condition caused by malnutrition. Let's assume that we can't get anyone who would testify that kind of sort of delirium would be caused under these circumstances. And let's further even assume that Charlie is willing to say that he had his faculties at that moment. He was just hungry and trying to save people, and he knew what he was doing. It was just he made a choice that this was the lesser of two evils. In fact, sometimes that's what this doctrine is called, the choice of evils doctrine.
There's extraneous circumstances, though. How do you say that? Special circumstances that make this case set apart from the normal case.
Right, are they special enough?
Yes.
How would you make that argument? How would you say Charlie is entitled
exactly
to kill Eddie?
He'd do the same thing he just did for him. You would have to spell it out just like you did for us. You'd have to tell the story. Set the stage.
I guess then I have some questions, though. How is it that Eddie ends up dead? Last we heard, he wasn't agreeing to being any part of the lot. It's a little suspicious to us that he's the one person up here who has no relative in the cave with him, and he ends up dead. He sounded pretty good last we talked to him. There's that problem. But that's a purely a factual problem, right? That's just in there to demonstrate that no case ever presents itself totally clean. All cases have these terrible things called facts associated with them, and there's always some ways of interpreting it. And that's why the problem is set up this way. The person who ends up dead is probably the last person you'd expect. Eddie is usually not so colorful as to retain a lawyer, though. That's a wonderful turn of events. Can a person agree to his own homicide? That is, will the law recognize as valid? Let's assume that the five of them made the agreement. Do you think the law ought to permit people to make that kind of agreement? Anything going on in the news? Yeah, I mean, that we're rehearsing that issue over and over in Michigan, right? With Dr. Jack, right?
Can we collaborate with his attorneys at this point?
Well, the law of Michigan is a little more friendly to Dr. Kevorkian than the law I just read to you. Michigan has some oddities in their homicide structure and some history of permitting an out in these situations, which are very helpful there. And it's a little bit different, too, for the person who has absolutely chosen to die and now needs help, and with the people in this situation who don't want to die, but are sort of forced by circumstances to enter into an agreement to die. So that may make, I don't know that it would make a legal difference. It seems to me at some level to make a moral difference. At the moment of the killing in this case, if we picture it, Eddie was opposed to the act that would kill him. He may have agreed ahead of time. That's a factual question. But even if he had agreed ahead of time, you notice how whenever you draw straws, if you lose, you reassess whether you should have been part of the... So Eddie is reassessing even as they're killing him. And one of the interesting parts of the dynamic here is that the act of actually killing takes a certain amount of strength. And so there's a certain case in which it's almost always one of the stronger people who actually is doing the killing, rather than one of the weaker. So it has that kind of funny dynamic to it.
But it's a group that have made the decision, actually, the way I look at it. So mm-hmm. I think they all be equally guilty in the act itself.
Yeah. I think that certainly it's true that if Charlie can be found guilty of homicide, then the other three can be also. Okay. It's probably theoretically true that Eddie was a participant in his own death. Of course, at this point, he's beyond the reach of the law. But I would not think that we would just convict Charlie. I think we would convict everyone if we convicted anyone because they were part of... We would simply, what would we call that?
Conspiracy.
That's a conspiracy, sure. And that's exactly how the law of conspiracy works. If they're all in on it, they all are there. Let's leave that one alone for a second. And on the blue sheet here, if you're near someone, fine, I'll read them anyway. I want to give you some other variations on this theme. Other ways of thinking of the same sort of problem. I want to start with number 12 there. So don't go by numbers. A lot of these I don't want to deal with you because they're not really about this issue and they're for law students who are studying other things. But the ones that would apply to us is number 12. Car guy is driving down a narrow mountain road which has sheer rock walls on either side. Through no fault of his own, his brakes give out. And there's no way he can stop the car, which picks up speed dramatically. Students try to figure out a million ways to stop this car. I'm not going to let you stop this car. Okay? The facts you're given is sheer rock, narrow road, can't stop the car, but you can steer the car. Car guy can, however, still steer it. As he comes around a corner, he is faced, in each of the following cases, with having to steer left or right to avoid one lane and thus hit what is in the other. There is no going down the middle, or everything gets hit. A, left lane, 5 kids. Right lane, 1 adult. Car guy steers right, killing the adult. Car guy is prosecuted for murder. How do you think that case would come out? And there are, believe it or not, cases like this.
He's not guilty. He couldn't help it.
Couldn't help it. Had to make a choice. There's a sense in which when he killed the adult, he intended to.
It was an accident.
No, his option to do it, though.
It's his choice to do it. In that sense, he kills the adult on purpose. He didn't put himself on purpose into a situation where he had to choose this or this.
So it's manslaughter, isn't it?
Typically, this would come out that he would have a complete defense. That he would be guilty of no homicide crime at all, and the defense would be called necessity or would be called choice of evils. So he would have a complete defense. Right? B, left lane, kid. Right lane, big cardboard box. Car guy steers right, hitting box. Box contains 2 kids who die. Car guy for murder.
No intent.
Good, good. And I put this one in here for review for the students. In this case, car guy doesn't have the intent to kill anyone at all. He thinks he's, okay, fine. That's the complete defense there. Left lane, adult. Right lane, fine Monet painting on easel. Car guy is an art lover and steers left, killing adult. Car guy for murder, and I'll up the ante as much as you want. This could be an original Monet.
He's guilty.
I spent some time in a building in New Haven, Connecticut, which housed a rare book library, the Beinecke Rare Book Library of Yale University. And my office was 3 levels down in what was called the International Law Library, but it was all part of the Beinecke Book Center. On the walls was a notice in huge level said, this building protected by CARDOX, big letters. And then when you read the legend, it says, these books in here are so valuable that should the fire alarm go off, you have precisely 45 seconds to get to the door to get yourself out. At that point, all the doors are locked shut and we let go of the carbon dioxide which will put out the fire immediately and protect these books. It will have a very bad side effect for you, which is your immediate death. Well, I timed it, and I could get there in 30 seconds. But, you know, I doze off a little bit. There were other people down there who were older than I were and who were further back, and I wasn't sure they could make it. So I went up to the librarian, who was...
wearing track shoes.
Yeah. And I said, and I tried to make this as a sort of jovial and joking a fashion I could. I said, yeah, we just read the notice about the car docs. It's almost as if these books are more valuable than the people. And he said, oh, but they are. Okay. True story. So if he were on the jury in his case, perhaps he'd sympathize with Carmen. I want you to look at number. But I think that generally speaking, there the law has a very rigid rule, and the rigid rule here is human life always is to be preferred over property. And so any choice of this type will be punished.
Thank you. Has that been challenged in the courts?
Hmm?
Has that been challenged in the courts?
Yeah, but it's been challenged, but that's the rule that has developed in almost every state, that human life will be valued over property in this kind of choice. Yeah.
So if that is true, and that building did catch on fire, and people died as a result of this car box, would that not be found illegal?
Perhaps it was a chance they were willing to take.
Who was willing to take at the university?
Yale University.
Wow. Yeah. I'm a librarian, but
that's what it's like.
Whoever goes in there, if they know it. Whoever goes in there, if they know it, you know. Science.
There is that. See, they do go out of their way to get you notified. On the other hand, they assigned me that office. It wasn't as if I had a whole lot of choice as to where to go. But yeah, they do warn you, and that, of course, they have to do.
Yep. But what about property? Say that was some serum there that could save other people's lives.
Then it's not life against property. Then it's life against other lives.
Okay.
Then you get it up there. Okay. Number 14.
On this Monet example here.
Yeah.
If somehow the guy knew, the car guy knew that the guy in the other lane,
mm-hmm.
he had escaped from prison. He had one lung due to his
right.
body. He had
love
probably
it.
A week to
love
live.
It. I love it. He's 175 years old. His one lung. And that's the other one. Sometimes these cases come up in the context where it's this life or that life, one against one. And then you get into questions like, does age matter? Does health matter? And that's where the law says, sorry, beyond us. And you know who ends up solving those questions?
Jury.
That's right. See, one of the things that a jury is a lot of things, but one of the things that the jury is the repository for unanswerable questions. And you know, there's a whole lot of procedure, and some states have gotten past that now, but a whole lot of procedure that once the jury is done, you're not allowed to talk to them. The lawyers can't talk to them, the parties can't talk to them. It's as if these 12 people come together, they form this group, they make this decision as a group decision, and then they go their separate ways, and you can't kind of go after them individually, because they didn't decide it individually, they decided it as a group. I've often thought, you know, the old way of explanation is, we don't want to find out how a jury arrives at its decision. Okay? Because we'll find out that they have no reason for their decision. In fact, there's a wonderful case where the study, they actually listened to the jury deliberate. In a couple of cases, they got special court approval to do this. And in one case, they were deadlocked and they didn't know what to do. And finally, one juror said, Well, you know, I'm kind of remembering that, didn't they say somewhere during the trial that the defendant was a vegetarian? And a lady on the panel said, yes, they did say that he was a vegetarian. And the guy said, well, I say convict him. I don't trust anybody who isn't a Methodist. And they did. So, you know, I'm not sure if we don't want to know what the jury does because we know that they'll decide it like that, or maybe we'll find out that they know more than we do anyway, and they have a better way of getting at these things. So we leave that kind of case to the jury. Yes, sir?
I was on a medical malpractice suit several years ago, and we were polled after the...
To make sure it was really your verdict. Yeah. Right, that's fair.
We knew how people voted.
Right. That's fairly standard to make sure that you don't have an 11-to-1 situation and they say, well, let's just go in and let's call this guy's bluff. Let's just go in and say we're unanimous and let's see if he has the guts to stand up in open court and say, no, I'm the guy that's holding out here. And so they poll you. Some states now are letting people talk to jurors afterwards.
I was going to just say, in all of our civil trials,
right,
the attorneys talk to our jurors.
Right.
Do you think there'll ever be a professional jury in lieu of a jury of your peers?
Well, there already is. In a variety of cases, in a lot of states, medical malpractice cases go to a panel of experts.
I see.
At least initially, sometimes you get an appeal after that to a regular system. Mm-hmm. But yeah. I want to do one more case, then we can talk generally, and that's the last one. A fire threatens 20 houses. A notices that if B's house is destroyed, the resultant fire break will save the other 19 houses. A burns down B's house. And I have it set up here to charge A with arson, but you could also have it in a civil case where B sues A for the value of the house. That is a real case. That is a real case. How would you think that would turn out? Then I'll tell you what the court said. Yes?
Yeah, I'd want to know if A was an expert on firefighting. If anybody can come up and make any decision, well, if I burn down this, it'll be helpful. But I mean, she'd have some basis for taking an action on that, I would think.
In the actual case, a man named Geary was a public official who was the alcalde of San Francisco.
What's that?
The person who apparently had the authority in, and I don't know exactly what alcalde means, it sounds like a Spanish word to me.
Isn't he a mayor? Doesn't mayor. The alcalde is a mayor.
The mayor. There it is. And he decided by virtue of his office to destroy the building. And he did. Again, there were some horrible little facts there, like whether he did it too early and whether he did it before they could get all the stuff out of the house that they wanted to get out of the house. There were no living things in there. But at any rate, he destroyed it. It did, in fact, save all the other houses. And it seems quite clear that if he had simply let the fire burn, it would not only have burned the other 19 houses, it would have burned this person's house too. So it looks as if this person's house was gone in either direction. It happened to be the first one in the path of the fire, so it was the right one to blow up. Here's what the court says. The right to destroy property to prevent the spread of a conflagration has been traced to the highest law of necessity, and the natural rights of man, independent of society or civil government. Think about that. One of the arguments that can be made in the Spelunker case, and often is the argument that the five people in the cave ought not to be understood to be under the law of the state in which that event has transpired, but to be in something like a state of nature at that point. And out, we don't want to say above the law, that's a problem.
Below the law.
Well, yeah, below the law. outside the law, in which case their actions get judged not by the law of the state they're in, but by some kind of natural law formulation. That's pretty tricky, too. We don't want to say they're outside any kind of law. We don't want to say they're strictly a law unto themselves, but that maybe there's some kind of general or natural law under which we look at their behavior. The interesting thing here, when they say, this is clear, this is traced to anything, it's not traced to any cases. It is referred to by moralists and jurists to the same great principle which justifies the exclusive appropriation of a plank in a shipwreck, though the life of another be sacrificed. Interesting problem. With the throwing overboard goods in a tempest for the safety of a vessel. Again, that's a property case. With the trespassing upon the lands of another to escape death by an enemy. Some of the earliest necessity cases were you had to walk across someone else's land to escape an enemy, or if the road were blocked. A lot of the early cases, the road is blocked. If you take your horse and carriage around the blockage in the road, you happen to, of course, go on someone else's land, they sue you for trespass. And the rule was, no, you're privileged to do that. It's necessary for you to go around there. If while you were on their property you caused any damage, you'd have to pay for it. But you could technically trespass. The problem in this case, of course, that the house was not only damaged, it was completely destroyed. And the court in this case held that the alcalde was within his rights to destroy it, and that therefore B has no way to recover money for his house.
Fire insurance.
Yeah. This is one of those cases where the regular civil law, what we call the law of torts, is actually much worse than a different compensation system, which is the insurance system. And if you have fire insurance here, that solves the problem. Everybody's happy, except, you know what? Maybe excluded in the policy because it's an intentional destruction, and the policy may exclude it. I can tell you what would happen today. If this one happened today, and let's say you didn't have insurance, let's say it were your house, if the people who made the decision to destroy it were acting on behalf of the government, you would be paid by the government because this would be considered a taking of private property for public purpose. The public purpose in this case was to save the other one. It's like eminent domain. Yeah.
Sure.
It's like when they take your property to build a road, they have to pay you for it. If this were done by a private person, you would just have to absorb the loss yourself. Because the private person would have the defense of necessity. The takings doctrine only applies to governmental people. And if you have no insurance, that's the end of the road. What would be nice, you see, that's if you lived in the right kind of community, what would happen?
Everybody would pay.
The other 19 ought to pay because the destruction happened for their benefit. That was its purpose. So you can't make them pay legally. But in a community that doesn't operate by that kind of strict law, that's probably the nicest solution we can get, is to have them absorb the loss equally among the 20.
The cost of the taking of the property seems to me should be limited to a half an hour or an hour, you know, whatever that value is before the fire would have wiped the place out anyway.
That's another that's a very difficult evaluation question. There's a very famous case which law students study about a boy who falls off a very, very high bridge. Very high bridge. There is no question that the boy is going to die. On the way down, he is killed by high tension wires, which were negligently maintained. The company agrees that they were negligently maintained because they had no insulation at all. And the court said that the people who maintained the lines were negligent and had to pay the damages. And the damages were the value of the rest of a boy's life, taking into account that he had about 2 or 3 more seconds to live.
Okay.
Yeah, and so the award was 6 cents. Okay. Huh?
That's good.
Yes.
Well, I was wondering, with any one of these cases, if you get into the area of religious freedom, because I know my uncle in Norway is on the court and had to make a decision on one that did. But anyway, I was thinking, like, back to the people in the cave, okay, and we hadn't ascertained their religious convictions real clearly, but I'm thinking of something like the scripture, no greater love hath a man that he lay down his life for his brother.
That's our friend here.
Right, that's him right there. Okay, now, I'm wondering how involved the court gets if they would profess that they had an experience with the Lord or something, you know, that, and all of them felt in this manner, you know, that, how involved does the court get when you get the division between church and state in an issue like that?
Well, let's change it a little bit. Because basically the First Amendment is going to run out when you come into action which violates the criminal law. We know that, for example, with the Mormon experience and the state of Utah passing bigamy statutes. The Mormons said, we have a religious practice, we have the right to that practice. The First Amendment says you can't prosecute us under the bigamy laws, and the Supreme Court says, oh yes, they can. Because we're not talking about beliefs or mere association. We're talking about actions, and that's usually where the First Amendment runs out. You can find a few cases where at the border you get some, you may be familiar with the case that came out of Oregon not long ago, 5 years ago, in which Native Americans were being prosecuted for the use of peyote in a religious service. Had a long, long standing tradition as part of their service. It was sacramental. But it also violated Oregon state laws, the drug laws. And the Supreme Court of the United States held that that conviction would be upheld. Okay, now since then, Oregon has in fact changed its policy. But at least as a legal matter, the Supreme Court said, no, the First Amendment wouldn't prevent that.
So usually the First Amendment doesn't hold up, you're saying?
When it comes to action.
Okay, when it comes to action.
That's covered by the criminal law.
Okay.
That's correct. We get that in the sacrifice of animals case, in the Florida case, the Hialeah case,
and the Jehovah's Witness case of blood transfusion and so on.
The blood transfusion, now that's different if you're talking about an adult who can decide not to be transfused.
Right. But
with a child, the court will order that transfusion.
Christian Science too.
Right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.